Welcome, and thanks for listening to the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast. We're broadcasting from the University of Missouri campus in Columbia, Missouri, home of the Missouri Review, the quarterly that brings you the best contemporary literature in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Every week, we'll be featuring a wide range of readings and interviews with writers, editors, and agents.
Today on the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast, we're interviewing TMR's editor, Spear Morgan. Spear, PhD, Stanford University, has been associated with the Missouri Review from its inception and has served as editor-in-chief of the Missouri Review since 1979. A professor of English at the University of Missouri-Columbia since 1972, Spear is among the most respected editors in literary publishing. As the editor of the Missouri Review, he has been responsible for co-administrating grants from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses, the Missouri Arts Council, the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, and the City of Columbia Office of Cultural Affairs. In 1985, he created the Missouri Review Trust, the journal's endowment, which is currently the focus of a major fundraising effort. The author of 5 novels and a collection of short stories, and the editor of 3 other books, he's a past recipient of an NEA Fellowship for Fiction and the recipient of an American Book Award for The Fresh Hour Cylinders, a novel published in 1998.
For this episode of the TMR podcast, we're here with the entire audio team for spring of 2018. So we'll just go around the table so that each intern can introduce him or herself, tell us a little bit about themselves, and then we'll continue with the roundtable interview.
My name is Bennett Jacobs. This is my first semester interning at the Missouri Review, and I am a junior at the University of Missouri.
My name is Kelsey Hurwitz, and I'm a senior at the University of Missouri, and I'm from San Jose, California.
My name is Emily Stanley. I'm a senior at the University of Missouri, and I'm from Jefferson City, Missouri.
My name is Sarah Beard, and I am a junior at the University of Missouri, and I am from Kansas City, Missouri.
And I am Bailey Boyd. I am one of the audio editors.
And I'm Tracy Cox. I'm also one of the audio editors.
And I'm Spear Morgan, the editor.
So for our first question, Spear, we would like to know, what's the difference about the Missouri Review compared to other literary journals out there?
I would say that there are two or three things that writers who are already in the zone of like submitting their work and sort of knowing about literary magazines, there are several things that are specific to the Missouri Review. One is that we publish poetry features rather than single poems by poets. So we publish about 12 poetry features per year in the 4 issues that come out. But they're lengthy features that include 6 to 8 poems by each poet. So that's one thing that's for those who are kind of insiders and who want to know the difference between our magazine and others, that's a key element. And of course, we do 8 to 10 nonfiction pieces. And the Smith Prize is a pretty big deal because it's a $5,000 award for each category. I think that overall, most people would agree, and this even out in the field, most people would agree that we are known as a magazine of discovery. We have a policy of appreciating early career writers. And even, you might say, of hoping for firsts. And, of course, we have, over the years, had a lot of firsts. Wally Lamb, Brett Law, Michael Byers, Danielle Offrey, Susan Vreeland, William Gay, Ellen Hensey, and so on. I mean, there have been many, many writers whose first work we published. So we really are known as a magazine of discovery. And that is because we use the old-fashioned method represented by you guys, who are all interns here or who work for the magazine, of actually reading 3,000 to 5,000 manuscripts per issue of the magazine. So it's closer to 5,000 per issue of the magazine. So we are truly open submission and truly looking for the best that we can find, regardless of previous fame, reputation, recognition, notice, whatever. A good example of that is that the upcoming prize issue of the magazine, the one that we are working on now, editing right now, has two firsts in it. The winner in fiction is Tamara Titus, and her story, Exit Seekers, is a first fiction publication by this author. And this is from among about 1,000 submissions in that area, including many experienced writers. To us, this was the best fiction submission. There's also another first in that same issue. So the same issue among not just the publications, but even the, you know, the prize winners and runners-up includes two firsts. Coach Schwartz by Andrew Da Silva is a runner-up and a first story publication. Andrew Da Silva is a practicing writer, but fiction is not his principal genre, so it's a first for him too. So, yes, we're known as a magazine of discovery. Yes, we do poetry features. Yes, we have an internship that we try to make useful for our interns and try to let them experience the world of editing and begin to really learn the world of editing by doing it. And this allows us the labor necessary, frankly, to actually read all these manuscripts. When you visit your friends who are publishing in New York, who are working as editors or agents or working in agencies in New York, you always hear the same story. You know, we don't have time to go through all this stuff. So if you're a medium-level editor, for example, at a central house, I mean, there's no way you're going to deal directly with writers. You're just going to deal with agents. And it's just a way to filter the chaos that they have to deal with. And what that results in is it does provide a filter for them, but it also prevents them from doing the kind of discovery that they really need to do. And so a magazine like the Missouri Review and the other good literary magazines are really useful for publishers in terms of getting to know authors, getting to know their work, and so forth. The other couple of things that I can think of that are unique or different about the magazine is that we do these history as literature and found text features. And we started doing those in the 80s, and I'm not quite sure how it happened. I think we had a submission from a well-known author, but we published it, and it was just a letter from that author. And then we sort of latched on to this. It's a kind of interesting idea to publish previously unpublished work by famous people. And so I began to visit research libraries and did research. At first, I did a whole bunch of research at the Huntington in Los Angeles because it has the best collection of Mark Twain. And Twain was an obvious for us, Missouri. And so we did several previously unpublished pieces by Twain and then moved on from there and did an unpublished early story by William Faulkner and Jack Kerouac and Laurence Olivier and so forth and so on. But we began to move around between libraries and go to the British Library, for example. Laurence Olivier came from the British Library and the Kerouac stuff. And we've had two or three features related to the Beat Movement that are really intriguing pieces. And we run them not just to run a previously unpublished work by a famous person, but to use it and the introduction to it as a kind of excuse to get to know this interesting fact about the writer and about his or her career. For example, one of the things that we did by Twain was a play. And interestingly, in publishing this play, it had never been published before. And it was the item in his career that made him the most money, and it had never been published. And the reason it had never been published is because it's a so-so play, very typically 1880s, 1890s kind of play. And it was a fun piece, but, you know, it's not the greatest play in the world. But it was the literary entity item that made him the most money. And the Laurence Olivier thing, which we got in the British Library, was interesting because, I mean, here he is kind of the king of acting in England from the 30s on. And this piece is a group of letters that he wrote to young actors who write him letters asking his advice. And he actually bothered to dictate letters to them. In fact, sometimes quite detailed letters to them about certain things that he was interested in answering. For one thing, you learn that Laurence Olivier was fascinated by makeup. He was a makeup fiend, and he got a letter about makeup from a guy. And the letter that he responded with was just in vast detail about all these different sort of makeup items and elements that he used that were very little known. And he actually put his own makeup on. And when he played Othello, it took him 2 hours to put it on, 2 hours to take it off each night. But I'm going on. But the point is that we do these features, and they have a scholarly element, but we are primarily oriented toward writers, and particularly with a kind of focus and hope for discovering new writers.
Spear, following up on that, this is a question from Brooke Delaney. She's one of our audio interns that couldn't be here today. Her question is, what are some risks that you wish more writers would take in their writing?
That's a good, hard question, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you appreciate a writer who has learned his or her medium, you know. You appreciate a writer who knows the basics, say in fiction, for example, who knows the basics about movement and concept and place and the vitality of all those elements in fiction. Most of them are in writing programs. Most of them have been working on their, and I'm just talking about fiction now, obviously, but you hope that they know these basic facts. But I would say the thing that I think about the most is something related to concept or theme in fiction. I really like for a story to have a describable concept and an interesting theme. And the theme can be quite unobvious. It doesn't have to be some obvious theme, like, you know, be kind to your neighbor or something like that. It can be something quite elaborately strange. I like for stories to have that kind of coherence. I think in poetry, you know, you look for voice. You really look for voice, identifiable voice, and all the wonderful elements that lyric poetry allows, the ability to be vivid and direct and personal. When I was doing my PhD work, I wrote my dissertation on Robert Lowell. And my first interest in that world was, you know, the confessional poetry that dominated the last part of the century. It almost seemed as if it happened by accident. You had Lowell writing his formalist poems in the 1940s, and they were elegant, wonderful poems. But he happens across these direct voice poets among Bohemians, and almost against his will begins to write these personal, confessional, direct, and yet still highly lyrical poems. And so you had the confessionalism of Plath, who was a student of his, and you had the lyricism and elegance of person whose whole career started with formalist poetry. And if I had to confess to a weakness, I would confess to the weakness of those two elements, a kind of formal clarity and a confessional directness in poetry. Even with this genre, I also look for clarity of concept. I want to be able to describe why I like these poems, you know, what they're about and why I like them. The short answer is that I would hope authors will allow themselves to be as truthful as possible and as interesting as possible and as direct as possible to discover things in their work that's interesting. And again, it comes around to having a describable kind of purpose for a piece. Those are the kind of things that I look for and wish there was more of in all the genres.
I think that kind of answers my question.
What was your question?
Mine was, are there any specific elements you look for picking winners for contests?
Well, you know, it doesn't hurt to repeat the basics of concept and movement and place. And by place, I mean a clarity of setting. A lot of really fine work is mostly interesting because of how it reveals a place. And that place need not be exotic. It can be quite commonplace. It can be a kitchen, you know, it can be a person's house. The milieu and place really matters. But I would say that one of the things that I end up talking a lot about to young writers is movement. And one of the clear points of discovery for young writers is how to handle movement in fiction. And by movement, I mean the distinction between scene and narrative and the interactive ability to move between scene and narrative and the ability to come up with a vivid, voice-driven narrative point of view. So I think those things are really important, and it's all part of movement. When it's a good story, it usually has good movement. The author has figured out how to focus on certain things and then how to move. And that's kind of one of the thrills of fiction. You feel like you're in the hands of a storyteller or a good poet if those qualities are apparent or present.
In what ways, if any, have your literary preferences changed since working for the Missouri Review?
I would say that I have become far more open to variety and different sort of types of stories. I mean, if you look at some of the stories that we've published over the years, I can just name a few of them and the kind of variety that they show. Titanic Victim Speaks Through Waterbed, Robert Olin Butler. We published that story in 1996. And it's a wonderfully experimental story in which a man who died on the Titanic keeps rediscovering himself in molecular form. And at the current time, at the focal time in the story, he's in a waterbed, and he doesn't know what a waterbed is, but the reader figures it out. So it's a humorous story. It's a high-concept story with a very inventive concept because he's going through all these different sort of bodies of water in his reincarnated forms. And he's seeing all this different world. And he's revealing to us what happened to him on the Titanic, which is that he fell in love in the last hour of the sinking of the Titanic with a young woman, the first love of his life. So it's humorous. It's high concept. It's a far out experimental story. That's the best story in that collection. Robert gave us that story. He let us pick the best story from that collection because we had been early publishers of his work. That was right when he won the Pulitzer Prize. And he gave us that collection, said, pick your favorite and pre-publish it. That's a wonderful story. So there you've got a high concept experimental story, or you've got a story like those Deep Elm Brown's Fairy Blues by William Gay, which we published 2 years later in 1998. And it is a classic, well-made story. It's got really good voice, it's highly lyrical, and it's tragic. It's quite unusual for short fiction to function well in tragedy, but this story really has a tragic feel to it, and part of it is because of the elegance of the voice. So there you have two quite different stories, one that's highly experimental and far out and imaginative, and there you have an old-fashioned, well-made, lyrical voice story. Or a story that we published in the year in between, in 1997, it was called Flame by Ha Jin. It's about a Chinese woman who is a competent person, she's married, she's relatively successful, and she receives a note announcing that her old true love is about to come for a visit. The story ends up being a sly kind of critique of materialism in Chinese culture and expectations. So it's a very intelligent thematic story about current Chinese culture. And that's also quite different because it's very thematic and very, very intelligent. Another story that we published more recently, about 8 years ago, was called Exotic Animal Medicine by Fiona McFarlane. Published that in 2010. And it's about a young Australian woman who's going to school in England and undergoes a disturbing set of incidents on the day of her marriage with her English boyfriend. And she's supposedly like starting a new life and everything's been set up for this perfect marriage. But it becomes this really intriguing set of mysterious events in her life that are finally well explained in the story. It's reminiscent of Catherine Mansfield. I mean, it's that kind of fiction. Or, you know, we published a story 5 years later called July Sun by Amina Ahmad. And it is a highly thematic story with a almost journalistic punch in terms of its theme, because it's about how vicious some societies can be toward those who defy convention, and how intransigent cultural norms can be in some societies. And this is set in a provincial setting, and it has to do with a young couple who break certain set of rules and simply get exterminated for it. But I mean, it's almost like right now in the world, these things are happening for religious reasons. So there are all different kinds of stories there. And I would say that if there's anything in terms of the way I've changed, is that I'm really open to all kinds of stories. And our magazine is traditionally very open to all kinds of pieces. I mentioned the Tamara Titus, the winner in the Smith Prize this year, the Exit Seekers story. It's about this guy named Ben Gibson, who is a diabetic amputee living in a home, and he's got a nicotine habit, and that's his like one last thing that he's got and can do and have fun with. But I mean, it's about this character in this extremely limited environment where he has very few choices of any kind, and yet in the story it's revealed how that even in that kind of limitation, even in that kind of end-of-life situation, some people can still be humane and decent and open and helpful. And it's kind of a miraculous story in the sense of you hear about me describe it, a diabetic amputee living at home on his way out, you know, it sounds terrible. But it's not at all terrible. It's a wonderful story about humane kindness, you know, and it's coming from him. This character, he's not a good guy. He's not a perfect guy. He screwed his whole life up. But still, he is humane. And it's just a well-done little piece. Coach Schwartz, the Andrew Silva piece, the other first, the runner-up in the Smith Prize this year, is about this professional tennis player now who is now serving as a coach for a high school tennis team and having this kind of half-hearted affair with a young woman. But it's about him sort of finding meaning in his life, and he finds meaning by being, I mean, he's got all these problems. He lives on a prescription painkiller haze, and he's got all these issues in his life. But he is deeply caring and loving toward his niece, who he has become the surrogate parent for. And it's just this really well-done story about a man in a profound dilemma. He was going to be a superstar, and he didn't quite make it. And he's still the best tennis player within 100 miles, but he'll never be famous. And his life is now limited, but he really cares about this niece who he's now serving as a parent for. The subject of a story can be anything, and the method can be interesting because of the fact that the author has made this material vivid and compelling, even though it's about someone in a dilemma or in living a very limited life or whatever it may be.
My question is, do you find being located in the Midwest influencing the magazine? If so, in what ways?
I would say that the location doesn't matter that much. I mean, in many ways, it's a positive because we're at a good university. We have students working on the magazine who are not just interested in tasting a little bit of literature or doing a little bit of editorial work, but many of whom end up going off to New York and working as editors. And so our connections to New York remain very good, and we often go and visit with those now editors. So our connectivity is really good. So the fact that we're located in the Midwest and in Columbia, Missouri, and at the University of Missouri is largely beneficial because of the good people working for the magazine and because, quite frankly, it doesn't cost a fortune to run an enterprise like this.
My question is, what hopes do you have for the future of the Missouri Review?
The thing that we're working on right now is our university-based endowment. I mean, that's my focus right now. I'm trying to take advantage of my advanced age and solidifying the endowment before I retire. We started the endowment in the 80s, and I had no idea how to start it, but our existence was threatened, and the university was undergoing a budget crisis, and so I began to raise money just from sort of local resources and formed a board. And eventually, by 2000, we had about $100,000 in the trust, and that helped us. It was less than money because you're not making that much money up from $100,000, but less than money than the fact that we were undergoing this and undertaking to do this, undertaking to better support ourselves. So we reinvigorated that effort, and by about 2010, we had raised about $350,000 with our board. And now we are in the final phase of trying to reach 2 million, which would give us a substantial bump in terms of income to help fund all this stuff. It costs a lot of money to run a magazine because you've got place, you've got printing, you've got machinery, you've got all this kind of stuff. That's been a focus of mine, but in the process, you cannot forget the editorial side. You cannot, you have to make sure that everybody around you is focused on the editorial. And so we continue with the features and the previously unpublished stuff. you know, the art features are kind of new element of the magazine. I mean, relatively new. I mean, we kind of started 15 years ago, but we didn't really get going with the art element until about 10 years ago. And Christine Somerville does a lot of that. But, you know, contemporary art and photography, both on the covers and in the pages. So we've done features on Francesca Woodman and Richard Hamilton and Joseph Cornell and Ouija and Lee Miller and Tina Modotti and various other people, Michael West, various other. So that's another kind of new element of the magazine. In this latest issue, the art feature is, just to give an example, Christine Somerville did an art feature on Claggett Wilson, who is a little-known artist, but who did a series of really arresting World War I watercolors. He used brushes and paint to confront the insanity of the battlefield in World War I. He was injured twice and poisoned with mustard gas. He suffered all his life from that. But it was some of the best American art to come out of the war to end all wars. It's theatrical, dynamic, powerful stuff. It gives a real mood and emotion of war and the bitter realities of war. So that's an example of an art, a recent example of an art feature. We also have this curio cabinet in which we publish a really brief feature that kind of highlights an interesting element of literary history. And in this issue, the curio cabinet is glimpses into the world of Harry and Caress Crosby's Black Sun Press. And it was one of the several American presses set up in Paris in the 20s. Crosby was the nephew of J.P. Morgan. And so he was from a super rich family. And Caress Crosby was from Boston. She was mainline Boston. And their marriage was this kind of interesting, totally bohemian kind of relationship. But they ended up publishing amazing, important authors, Kay Boyle, Ezra Pound, James Joyce, Hart Crane, et cetera, et cetera. And it's an interesting piece because it gives a quick view into how dynamic Paris was as a cultural milieu for Americans in the 1920s.
How has working for the Missouri Review shaped your own writing style that you can determine?
That's a complicated question because there's a real different. I mean, I'm a fiction writer. I mean, I've done some nonfiction, but I'm primarily a fiction writer. And I've written both short fiction and novels, mainly. I spent most of my time with novels. And when I started writing fiction, I mean, I had a little bit of talent and a little bit of ability and voice and that kind of thing. And I had good subject matter. You know, I had interesting contacts and connections. I was working for Rolling Stone when it was still in San Francisco. And so, I mean, I knew I was working in a creative environment, but I had this illusion that you just invented stuff and you didn't plan and you didn't think about it. I had a kind of beat attitude toward writing, you know, that you just sort of spit it out of your soul. And what I learned the hard way, namely by having novels optioned and then turned down and all the other typical things that happen to young writers, what I learned was that the novel is a very unwieldy form and it requires some kind of directedness, planning, or natural unity. And if you don't have that natural unity, you better figure it out. So I would say that in my own work, I learned that planning and shaping and all that is a key element to long-form fiction. However, with the short story, you do have this wonderful luxury of being able to create a lyric story that has a natural beginning, middle, and end without really doing a lot of planning. So stories can be a lot more fun in many ways because you can, I mean, I wrote a story, for example, about a guy whose passion in life is liquid dynamics. And so I did all this research in liquid dynamics, which I knew nothing about, but which I've always found fascinating. You know, wave theory and all that kind of stuff. It's just absolutely fascinating. So it gave me the chance to investigate liquid dynamics and to create this voice of this maniac who's really a total believer in the importance of liquid dynamics. He's a millionaire, but he just invented something almost by accident. And, you know, I mean, in a story, you can do that kind of thing. You can toss it off and have fun. But with long-form fiction, it's a different thing.
Do you have any pieces of advice for aspiring editors or writers to do what you do?
You know, I would say that that the key thing for aspiring editors or writers, whichever you are, and you may be both, I would say that the key element, and I just think about the writers I know, Jane Gillette, whose career we now are trying to really set forth. We published her book. A characteristic of her work is that you would never know it by having lunch with her or whatever. You would never know it, but she's a profoundly hard worker. And she really wants those stories to be perfect. So I would say that both with editing and with writing, the ones who succeed are the profoundly hard workers. I'm thinking about some of the young editors I know in New York now. And it just amazes me. You know, for example, Ben George is a Lil Brown editor. And he's going to be a major editor. He's going to be one of the top editors in New York. And he's early career now. And the reason is that he really loves and cares about and spends 16 hours a day working on editing stuff, taking chances with authors, finding good stuff, reading literary magazines, you know, dealing with challenges. And believe me, there are a lot of challenges in publishing. I would say the simple answer is don't do it unless you want to work hard. If you want to work hard at it, you can do it. And particularly editing. If you want to be an editor and you really care about it, the really caring about it is step one and the working hard is step two.
Well, Spear, thank you so much for coming and speaking with us and giving us so much of your time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Missouri Review Sound Booth Podcast. Music by Mark Catalano. Did you know that the digital magazine, with both text and audio content, is now available for purchase through our free app? For the freshest new fiction, poetry, essays, and features, download it to your smartphone or tablet and never miss an issue. Search for the Missouri Review in your app store. If you are already a digital subscriber, just sign into the app with the email address associated with your account.